remotely in this argument. I do want to say a couple of things. First off, we have seen from time to time interruptions or technical glitches. If something like that were to happen, we will be patient with you and ask that you be patient with us on our end. In addition, because we're recording this, making an audio recording of this, if you would please make sure to state your name before you begin your arguments. That way we know exactly who is speaking. And if for some reason you're unable to hear or someone freezes or whatever, just let us know right away and we'll do the best we can to adjust our clock and to accommodate that problem. With that, Mr. Nyvold, let's have the case be called first. Go ahead.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, Judge Flory. Case number A20-0208 and A20-0610, State of Minnesota versus John William Litzau.
And with that, we can begin our arguments. Mr. Nyvold. And I can see that you're on mute, sir.
Your Honor, the state is the appellant.
Oh, thank you. You're correct. Mr. Stockmeyer, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing this morning on behalf of appellant and cross-respondent, the state of Minnesota. This morning, I do intend to focus my argument on the sufficiency issue from the state's direct appeal. I'll begin with the dispute over the standard of review and then move on to the legal analysis of sufficiency. But beginning with the standard of review, I want to give this court maybe an example which illustrates the state's problem with applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review in these types of cases. So I think we all agree that if a young child testifies that the defendant touched me in my vagina, he tickled me and it hurt, the direct evidence standard of review applies and the conviction as to penetration ought to be affirmed. Appellant's position in this case really comes down to if that child instead testifies that the defendant touched me on my vagina, tickled me, and it hurt, the circumstantial evidence standard of review applies and the conviction should be reversed because the child used the adverb on instead of in. And the state's position is really that a young child's description of detailed sexual conduct should not come down to what adverb the child uses as to whether a conviction should be affirmed or reversed. The child has firsthand knowledge of the conduct the defendant engaged in. The child communicates that to the jury, and the jury is really in the best position to parse out what the child is communicating. And so I think in these types of cases, those all counsel in favor of applying the direct evidence standard of review as opposed to the circumstantial evidence standard of review. But even if the court does not agree with us about which standard of review applies, I do think the state still prevails under the circumstantial evidence standard. The statutory language at issue in this case is that sexual penetration includes any intrusion, however slight.
Say, Mr. Stockmeyer, let me just ask you a quick question before you move on. Do you agree that the district court applied a circumstantial evidence standard of review in its analysis on the ruling on the judgment of acquittal on that count one charge?
Your Honor, I didn't get a clear sense of which standard of review the district court was applying.
Clearly he didn't say, but he's talking about a number of inferences he had to make.
Right. I think that that's where I would lean, because he does talk about assumptions that need to be made. That sounds like we're talking about inferential reasoning. And so I think that may have been the standard the district court had been applying. But I don't think that's correct. And this court has a de novo review of a sufficiency question when there's been an appeal from a post-trial motion for judgment of acquittal. And so the standard the district court applied, I don't think really matters.
So let me ask another question. It's not exactly standard of review in the sense that we're talking about the hypothetical, rational hypothetical or hypothesis versus direct evidence, but it comes from a citation in your brief that the test to be applied, so in other words, the standard, not the standard of review, but the standard to be applied, is whether the evidence is sufficient to present a fact question for the jury. And my question is, if that is that really the standard that we are applying, or instead are we applying whether there are facts in the record that would permit the jury to reasonably conclude guilt beyond a reasonable doubt? Is it simply enough to say there's a fact question, or are we looking at what would a reasonable juror do given the standard of proof in a criminal trial?
The latter, Your Honor, is the language from the sufficiency cases. Honestly, I've never quite understood how much daylight there are between those two, because if it's not reasonable for a jury to conclude from the evidence that the defendant was guilty, then there's not really a fact question for the jury. So I'm not sure how much daylight there is, but I am willing to acknowledge that the latter of the two sets of language you propose is the proper standard for the traditional evidence standard of review. So again, even if the court isn't convinced about which that the state is correct about which standard of review applies, the statutory language is that sexual penetration includes any intrusion, however slight. So in order to conclude that there the evidence was insufficient, this court has to conclude that the evidence left open the possibility that the defendant's contact with the victim's vagina involved absolutely no intrusion whatsoever. That is not a reasonable possibility given the circumstances proved in this case when they're viewed in the light most favorable to guilt, and all the questions of fact are resolved in the state's favor. And really, I think this case comes down to three circumstances proved. First, if we take the victim's statements and her clear physical indications at face value, the defendant touched the victim's vagina. Second, the victim stated that the defendant made a tickling motion while he touched her vagina. And third, that the defendant's movements of his fingers on her vagina caused her to experience pain. So the state's position is actually pretty simple. If we assume these three facts are true, touching of the vagina, movement of the fingers, and the experience of physical pain, it is not reasonable to conclude that the defendant's conduct involved no penetration whatsoever. When a person moves their fingers on a young child's vagina and the child experiences pain, the only reasonable inference to draw is that there was some, at the very least, some minimal amount of penetration in that contact. In coming to the contrary conclusion,
was there any evidence in the record to support that opinion that where the jury could make that inference? I mean, was there medical testimony that would say, in order to feel pain, there had to be some degree of penetration?
There wasn't any medical testimony or physiological testimony, Your Honor. I guess what I would say is that in order to feel pain, if there's no penetration, if it's mere contact, I think we'd really be in talking about someone striking the victim, not simply placing their hand there. Because I think that's the only reasonable conclusion to draw from the experience of actual pain. And so if we take the victim at...
Like, just to be clear, you're saying that pressure without penetration cannot cause pain? That it's so clear that you don't need medical testimony to support that inference?
In the absence of... If there's no penetration, Your Honor. If there's
right.
mere sexual contact.
Right. If there's pressure... If there's forceful pressure on the outside without penetration, you're saying that there's no reasonable way to conclude that anything other than penetration occurred.
That's our position, that's the only reasonable conclusion.
And what's the basis of, without being too anatomically specific, what exactly is the basis for that
conclusion? I mean, really just the jury's common sense is really what it comes down to in their lived experience, Your Honor. I mean, I acknowledge that there's no testimony one way or the other of the amount of pressure that would be required to cause pain. But I guess what I would say is that's not legally required in order for the state to make its case. So in reaching the contrary conclusion that the state failed to present sufficient evidence of penetration, I think the district court made three errors in its order.
Before you move on, Mr. Stockmeyer, is there an inconsistency in your circumstances proved between the first and the third? In other words, tickling and pain. Is there some inconsistency between those? Aren't you also saying, aren't you really just saying it's because she expressed that she felt pain, there's only one reasonable conclusion? And you're kind of putting aside the word used to describe the motion as tickling.
Your Honor, I guess when I'm emphasizing tickling, I'm speaking to the movement of the fingers that are implied by that. And so it's not just mere contact of the hand upon the genitalia. There's movement of fingers involved. And I don't think that the jury is required to necessarily conclude that there has to be the opposite of pain involved in tickling. I take that. I think the jury can infer from that that it's about the movement of the hand. So the first error the district court made in its order is that it concluded that the victim did not clearly express what part of her body the defendant actually touched. And honestly, I don't really see how one can draw that conclusion if we take the victim's physical indications on the video at face value, view them in the light most favorable to guilt, and assume they're true. And on at least four occasions, the victim very clearly pointed to her vagina on the video. And so we must take that as true. That is the area of her body that the defendant touched. The second error that the district court made is that it emphasized.
All right, it looks like Mr. Stockmeyer is frozen. And I'm glad the marshal has stopped the clock. We'll give it some time and maybe he'll have to log out and log back in and we'll all just be patient. Oh, he's back.
I can, Your Honor. So the second error the district court made is that it emphasized that at one point the victim stated that the defendant's fingers were not inside of her. And I think that comes down to a problem in properly applying the standard of review, whichever standard of review we're applying, because we have to view the facts in the light most favorable to guilt. And we have to remember that the jury is free to pick and choose what portions of the victim's testimony it finds credible. And so under the standard of review, I think we have to assume that the jury discredited that part of her statement. The third problem with the district court's order is that it concluded the evidence was insufficient because, quote, there is not testimony or evidence directly supporting the act of penetration. Again, we think we agree with that in terms of which standard of or disagree with that in terms of which standard of review applies. But even under the circumstance, but if that's true, there is no direct evidence of penetration. That doesn't end the inquiry because, of course, we have to address the analysis under the circumstantial evidence standard of review. And the question is whether what was proven, the circumstances proved, do those exclude reasonable inferences of guilt, a reasonable inference that there was no penetration whatsoever.
Mr. Stockmeyer, again, this maybe goes back to the standard of view, but who do you think is the appropriate fact finder when we're deciding what are the circumstances proved here? Because you have a jury verdict and then you've got a district court who stepped in.
It's the jury, Your Honor. This court's review on a sufficiency claim when there's been a post-trial motion for judgment of acquittal is de novo. It's the same as it would be if there had not been a motion for judgment of acquittal. So the jury decides what the circumstances proved are, which means we review the record as a whole and we take the facts that are most favorable to guilt. And those are the facts we examine for the circumstances proved.
And when we're looking at the reasonable hypothesis or rational hypothesis standard, do you see any issue here with applying that standard when the question is the element itself? In other words, you have a verdict that and the circumstance proved that you're looking at is the element itself. In other words, is it ever possible for a district court to grant a motion for directed verdict or as a matter of law when the circumstance itself is in dispute? I mean, aren't you just saying because there's a guilty verdict, therefore the element of penetration was proved, and therefore that's the end of it. That's sufficient. Don't we have to review? And it seems to me that the problem is that if the circumstance you're talking about is the element itself, you have a bit of a problem, because we would never be affirming a directed verdict.
Your Honor, everything you said makes perfect sense. I agree with everything you said, except that the circumstances proved that we're relying on in this case is not the element. The circumstances that we're relying on are the three facts I've mentioned: that he touched the victim's vagina, that it involved tickling, and that the tickling movement caused her pain. So it's about it when we're in the circumstantial evidence standard of review. It is about looking at what was actually proved and what can and cannot be inferred from those facts.
So what I don't understand completely about that argument, Mr. Stockmeyer, is one of the errors that you've assigned to the district court is the fact that the victim gestured toward her vaginal area four times. How does that not equally support sexual contact as opposed and sexual penetration? How can you rule out sexual contact simply by her pointing to that area of her body?
And Your Honor, I guess there may be cases where the only evidence is that the victim makes a physical gesture towards a particular body part, and the evidence of penetration may be insufficient there. Here we're looking at the totality of circumstances. And so it's not just what does each circumstance proved in itself preclude in terms of inferences we can draw. It is what is the totality preclude in terms of inferences we can draw. And as I stated towards the beginning of my argument, it's the combination of the body part that was touched, the experience of pain, and the movement of the fingers. And unless the court has any further questions, I simply ask that this court reverse the entry of judgment of acquittal on the greatest count and affirm the conviction on the lesser count. Thank you.
Mr. Nyvold.
Thank you. First of all, for the state to come in now and try to reassert, as it did in its original brief, a direct evidence standard of review is just not appropriate. I filed a brief and it lays out clearly what the correct standard of review is. The state had the option to file a reply to that. They did not do that. So I think that weighs heavily against now being able to assert a direct evidence standard of review, which in any event clearly is not the case here. Just look at the record. At the hearing on the motion for post-verdict motion for acquittal, the prosecutor refers to inferences that can be drawn from the trial evidence. And he said, penetration was again implied and able to be inferred from the testimony. In the section of his brief discussing the evidence, the state uses the words infer, inferred, or draw inferences a combined total of 9 times. So at the direct motion hearing, the state recognized that you have to draw inferences to be able to exclude, make it unreasonable to find that there's an inference inconsistent with guilt. And the judge had that argument in mind. The state is telling him, yes, this is a circumstantial evidence case. And although the court in its order didn't go through the exact framework, as I did in my brief, of review of a circumstantial evidence-based verdict, the court's analysis is really tracks that. It's consistent with circumstantial evidence review.
So that won't matter much at this point, would it? I mean, if we have a de novo review of whether there were circumstantial evidence sufficient to support the verdict, regardless of what the district court did, we would determine whether or not the conclusion was correct based upon our own circumstantial evidence review. Do you agree with that or not?
Yeah, yes, Your Honor. I just wanted to point out that I'm surprised that the state isn't proceeding on the basis of circumstantial evidence review. They're trying to take us back to a standard review that just doesn't apply on these facts.
Well, can you address then the argument that the only reasonable inference that can be drawn from tickling, painful, location and the term on is penetration?
Yes. First of all, there is nowhere in the record where to support the statement that Mr. Listow touched her on the hole. I mean, this is basically drawn from a part of the forensic interview, which the state has just sort of reshaped to fit its argument. And I'm referring here to page 22 of what was Trial Exhibit 5, the transcript of the argument. And, you know, there's the question, when John tickled the part that you showed me, what's the name of that part? The butt. The butt. And what do you use the butt, that butt, part of your butt for? Go poop or pee. To go poop or pee. Does poop or pee come out of the same part or a different part? You know, the hole that's under here. Now, the court in its order recognized that that answer, the hole, did not refer to what part he tickled. That was two questions earlier. It referred to, does poop or pee come out of the same or a different part? Okay. So there's nothing here to indicate that he touched her on the hole. You have to try to infer that, and the facts, the circumstances here aren't consistent with just that inference. They're consistent with contact. And then I would direct the court to the video, the forensic interview video. And Mr. Stockmeyer pointed out, well, you know, that shows that she was pointing at the vagina. No, it doesn't. There's four instances there where she is asked about where she was touched. And I want to stress, first of all, she's never asked how she was touched. So this claim of a poking motion is simply the state's reading or interpretation of the way she's pointing. They like to characterize it as a poking motion because that's somehow suggestive of trying having a purpose to try to penetrate the vagina, like repeatedly poking. That's their interpretation, but she never used that word in the interview. The questioner never used that word. But getting back to the video, if you look at every time she is asked to indicate where she was touched, she positions herself in a way that the crotch of her pants is pulled away and is taut, and she just sort of randomly points in that area. She wasn't asked to say, now tell me exactly where he touched you. And with her clothing being apart from her crotch and her touching it, you can't tell exactly where she's trying to indicate. It's certainly inconsistent with the inference that what happened here was contact. And the pain, she repeatedly backed off or sort of minimized this idea of pain, because every time she was questioned beyond the original, well, it hurt, she kept saying, I don't know, I don't know, I don't know.
Well, if I could pause you there for a moment as to your, as to the defendant's appeal, not the state's, wouldn't we at least acknowledge that the jury could choose what parts of her testimony to accept and which parts to decline? And if there was pain, doesn't that necessarily infer contact?
On the defense direct appeal, yes, the jury could do that. Yes. But that's not the analysis. I'm sorry.
No. So if that's the case, if there was contact, isn't that sufficient to as to the state, as to your appeal?
Yes. Yeah, well, I agree. I don't have the same argument to make, but without conceding the appeal, I would say you have a good point, Your Honor. Let me just put it that way.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So, getting back to the state's appeal. I've talked about the video. I was going to talk about waiver, that, you know, they've waived the right to contest this order, granting a post-verdict judgment of acquittal because they didn't state the correct standard review, but I'll move on from that. I just want to make clear that that's, and as the court knows from my brief, that they argued that.
When we're reviewing the district court's decision to grant a motion for, I keep calling it directed verdict. So I'll stick with that language out of force of habit. Essentially, what the district court is saying is that the jury was unreasonable when it reached its verdict. And in that circumstance, what do we do? How do we determine what circumstances were proved? If the judge below has concluded that the jury's verdict was unreasonable.
You know, I'm not sure that characterizing it as an unreasonable is the correct way to phrase it. Where there's circumstantial evidence, the issue is, does the verdict do the circumstances proven that had to be proven in order to convict, do they admit of inferences inconsistent with guilt? And so I don't think you need to get into a question of reasonableness or unreasonableness. It doesn't matter if there are multiple reasonable inferences, some consistent with guilt, some consistent with non-guilt. If in a circumstantial evidence case, if that reasonable inference of guilt or of non-guilt exists, that's it. You don't have to try to characterize the inferences that are consistent with guilt as unreasonable.
And what about determining what circumstances were proved when you have a jury's verdict that the district court disagreed with or said was not well-founded?
Well, I described what the circumstances proved are in my brief. And it's simply a matter, as this court and the Supreme Court's precedent has made clear, you know, what are the facts the jury had to find to convict? And I've summarized those, but yet those circumstances reasonably permit an inference inconsistent with guilt. And that's based on the court finding that there's nothing here to indicate it's reasonable to conclude that this wasn't penetration, that it was contact. You've got MG indicating that when asked, did his fingers go in the hole? No, they didn't. So whatever the hole is, they didn't go in it. Second, what is it that was proven that he touched? And you don't have anything in that makes it that excludes the inference that this touching didn't go reach the labial folds. That was the prosecutor's theory, that the finger didn't go in the hole, it had to have begun to enter into the labial folds. Again, there's nothing that makes it reasonable to conclude that no, if there was any pain or contact in that area, it didn't reach that. And you've also got the MG simply being able to articulate in any kind of way that makes it reasonable to find guilt, the difference between whether that hole is the anal sphincter, whether it's the vaginal opening. You just can't do that. And the area she describes is so broad in general that it's perfectly consistent with just contact in the vaginal region or possibly a butt cheek. So that's where the case, I think, ends up. And the court recognized that. And I think if it had been pointed out to him, well, use circumstantial evidence review principles, he would have put it in the right framework, but the analysis he used is, as I said in the brief, perfectly consistent with application of that framework.
Just to be clear, I wasn't, forgive me if you mentioned it and I forgot, were you not intending to address the trial errors that you assert on appeal in your oral argument? If you already declined to, if you already referenced that, I apologize for missing it.
Well, I do have a separate cross appeal raising trial errors. I'm going to rely on my brief for that. And the same for the count two, which is a separate direct appeal. So I'm relying on my brief for those defense appeal arguments. And I would just like to point out one thing that, you know, the court also found, and the state really hasn't opposed this, that there was an improper, the prosecutor committed misconduct in arguing that the only way to reach that point in the female anatomy is to make, to poke and penetrate through the folds of the labia. In other words, the court is indicating that the prosecutor really didn't even have a basis to argue that that's what had happened. It was just speculation to argue that. And he would have granted a new trial alternatively if he hadn't, he says he would have granted a new trial if he hadn't already decided to vacate the guilty verdict. Unless there are any questions, that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just very quickly, on my friend's characterization of some of the facts, I think there was some discussion about sort of parsing out how the victim may have positioned her hand technically in this one position as opposed to another position. Regardless of which standard of review we're applying, we view the facts in the light most favorable to guilt at the level of identifying the circumstances proved. The victim placed her hand in the area of her vagina. Viewing that in the light most favorable to guilt, it's very clear that she was telling the social worker that the victim touched her vagina and not her butt. That's just not that's the only way to properly look at those physical indications under either standard of review. And I think that goes for a number of the characterizations of facts that we see both in my friend's argument as well as the district court's order. We have to view those facts in the light most favorable to guilt. We have to resolve them in the state's favor when we're reviewing sufficiency.
If the victim had been a male instead of a female and the testimony had been the same with regard to tickling, painful, would you agree that in that circumstance, we would have a contact versus penetration only?
Yes, Your Honor. And so I guess the distinction between those two is the jury's ability to, using its common sense, understand that there is a body part that can be penetrated.
Right. And that's the problem I've got with your argument, is that it can be penetrated. But your answer to my question would indicate that if the anatomy were different, that the very testimony that you're relying upon would support only contact. And so I'm at a loss for why it might not support contact in this case, because if it's a reasonable inference, not necessarily the only one, but a reasonable inference, it seems to me that would defeat that would support the district court's conclusion.
Well, it's consistent with contact in either case. But it precludes mere contact in the instance of a female victim
That's the part that I think would need something more than common experience to conclude.
I guess I would just disagree with that, Your Honor. I think the jury can apply its common sense and understanding, maybe not the precise, specific details of female anatomy, but to understand that there is a body part that can be penetrated on a female victim there. I do not think the jury needs to have medical or expert testimony establishing that fact. And that's one of the reasons why we have juries.
I think your argument makes a lot of sense. as a closing argument, as a reasonable inference that can be drawn. I guess what I'm looking at is the standard of review here. If we're applying the circumstantial evidence standard of review, then the non-guilty hypothesis is contact and not penetration. It's just that little jump that I think that I'm troubled over.
And in the context of a prosecution with a male victim, one of the circumstances proved is almost certainly going to be that it's a male victim, and so the jury is able to understand that it's not a, there's no body part to be penetrated there. And also, I'm not sure there would be any charge for penetration, so I'm not sure that would come up.
No, my point is. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Judge Brian.
Sorry, I was going to move along, but go ahead, Judge Rob.
No, go ahead. I've pressed this issue enough.
So again, I'm going to come back to the circumstances proved and on what basis we can decide between a dispute about whether a circumstance has been proved.
And Your Honor, to just maybe better understand where you're heading, is this more
right.
of a question
you
about-
You say that the circumstance proved includes that there was pain. Mr. Nyvold's brief disagrees. Quoting testimony about when the victim was asked, did it hurt? She says, I can't tell you. Nope, it didn't. And so I don't know was another answer about whether it hurt. So the question is there a circumstance proved of pain? Because if you look at the three circumstances proved that you mentioned, it seems to me that pain is pretty key to being able to then infer intrusion or penetration. So if there is a dispute about whether that is in fact a circumstance that was proved, how does the appellate court resolve that dispute?
And Your Honor, may I answer since I'm out of time?
Yes.
So first on the facts, I'm pointing you to page 23 of the transcript, which is in the confidential addendum. When asked if it hurt that time or another time by the social worker, the victim says, quote, it hurted a little bit when I think she used John, when John tickled it. That's the direct quote. So that's
and what's the next question?
I don't believe there was a question after that. I believe there was a question. There were a question earlier in the testimony where she was asked, about whether it hurt, and she said, can't tell you, nope, it
right.
didn't.
In Mr. Nyvold's brief, he also quotes a question that follows the one that you pointed to, which is, it hurted a little bit, ? What did the hurt feel like, ? Answer, I don't know. So the point that Mr. Nyvold, I think, is making is that it's not a circumstance proved because it's so equivocal. And my question is a little bit different, which is, how do we resolve a dispute about whether something is proved or not?
You resolve that dispute by the traditional principles that apply in every sufficiency of the evidence case. You view the facts in the light most favorable to guilt. If there are inconsistencies or factual disputes remaining, you resolve those in the state's favor. And that's part of giving the jury its due deference at the first level of the circumstances proved. And if you want a case for that, Your Honor, I always like to quote the pretty recent State versus Harris case, where the Minnesota Supreme Court said that the circumstantial evidence standard of review protects those principles.
So in this case, the circumstance proved is only, and I quote, it hurted a little bit. That's the circumstance proved.
I agree, Your Honor. And the experience of pain is what we're relying on.
Well, I mean, the experience of pain, but it's qualified by it hurted a little bit.
It is qualified, Your Honor. I certainly accept that. Unless the court has any further questions, I simply ask that this court reverse the district court's grant of judgment of acquittal.
Do you think, Mr. Stockmeyer, that Harris says that you can ignore contrary testimony from the same person if there's inconsistent testimony? It hurt it a little bit versus I don't know what it felt like and nope, it didn't hurt. Do you think Harris suggests that you disregard contrary or inconsistent testimony?
No, Your Honor. I understand the reference to the standard of review protecting these principles as saying when we're identifying the circumstances proved, we do what we traditionally have always done in sufficiency cases. And if you want to cite, it's not in the briefs, that specifically says the jury is free to disregard parts of the victim's testimony, but not others. I'm more than willing to give you a cite to that. It's State versus Wright, 679 Northwest 2nd, 186. It's this court's opinion. This court said, in fulfilling its fact-finding responsibility, the jury is free to accept some aspects of a witness's testimony and reject others. And that is a first-degree crim sex case.
All right. Thank you both very much. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory timeframe.